The last time I stood here was Christmas Eve for the Christingle service. That finished with the children all holding their oranges with their candles lit, standing up here in front of the stable, which was here at that point, and singing Away in the Manger in a darkened church with their candles lit in front of them. Now, I'm giving you that as a memory because it's a lovely memory. And I think that after the reading which John has just done for us, we look back on that with fond nostalgia. And today's gospel reading strikes a very different tone. Poor John always seems to get the difficult roles because he was headed in the nativity play and he gets to read about the Massacre of the Innocents today, but it's not typecasting. So today's, as I say, it's a dramatically different tone. And it's because the anticipation of Advent is about that's finished now, and we're into the tenuous and dark days between a promise and the fruition of that promise. So Mary and Joseph have had to leave to go to Egypt, and they've had to question, probably like us, a bit of where the innocence of Christmas has gone. The wonder of the miraculous birth has soon given away to the brutal realities into which their baby was born. And now that's usually how innocence is lost, when the hope in life is usurped by events and circumstances that pull the rug from under us. The slaughter of the innocents can seem to challenge the innocence of Christmas. The notes of Away in a Manger have barely faded when we're asked to pack our innocence up like our Christmas decorations. Even our carols come with a sting. One of my friends said to me this year that she struggles to sing O Little Town of Bethlehem because she's visited Bethlehem and she's seen firsthand how divided that town is and the struggles it faces. Truth can fit uneasily into the lyrics of a Victorian carol. Yet this is the hard truth that the gospel text today makes us face, the truth for which you, like me, might not be ready. We're never ready to believe in or accept innocence lost. We become all too aware of those powers in the world that do not cherish life, but just seek to destroy it. The passage from Matthew today shows us what we refused to see last week, the underbelly of power, the systemic nature of sin. Let's look a bit more closely at the text. Our reading today from Matthew reminds us that while the Gospel of Luke reports Jesus' birth as it's told to the poor people of the world, the peasant people, such as the shepherds, the Gospel of Matthew presents it as a grand event, eliciting responses from the powerful representatives of the Roman and Jewish world, as well as drawing attention of visitors from overseas. That may be true, but the Gospel lesson for today makes clear that even in Matthew's Gospel, the glory days of gold, frankincense, and myrrh didn't last for very long. The reading for today is organised around the movements of four geographical locations that, taken together, will give us a downward spiral for Jesus' appearance, apparent career and success. Bethlehem is where Jesus is at the start of the lesson. It's the city of David, a place of great importance in Israel's tradition and in God's plan, the place from where the Messiah should be born. But from here, the Messiah doesn't spend much time. He travels, and doesn't travel to Jerusalem, which would be a powerful arc for him to go on. He travels into Egypt, and Egypt is a land that we could say has ambiguous connotations. It's, of course, the place of bondage from which God had to deliver the people in the Exodus, but it's also sometimes a place of refuge. Matthew tells the story of the Holy Family's flight to Egypt with incredible irony. It's the Exodus. In the Exodus story, babies were slaughtered in Egypt by the wicked Pharaoh. But now righteous Jews must flee to Egypt to escape a massacre of infants in their own land. Soon the family is directed back to Israel where they belong. But again, another problem arises and they wind up in Galilee. Now Galilee is commonly known as the Galilee of the Gentiles. Though it's part of the northern kingdom of Israel, the land had never really recovered from its fall to the Assyrians. And so it was now widely populated with foreigners. And I think foreigners had a resonance for the Israeli people at that time, as it has for some of us now. The Jews in Judea considered the Galilean Jews only a step above the Samaritans. So here, this setting was not a wise career move for someone who wanted credentials as a Messiah. Then he goes to Nazareth, which is even worse. It was a little agricultural town with a population of about 500, and was so insignificant that archaeologists and historians sometimes deny that such a place ever existed. Can anything good come out of Nazareth? Might have been the motto of the city. So what do we get from this? This portion of the Matthew narrative presents an unexpected turn in the career of Jesus, the Messiah, a turn towards lowliness and humility rather than towards grandeur and greatness. After leading the reader to believe that Jesus would be the one before whom the kings of the earth would bow down, Matthew now reveals that Jesus is to be identified with helplessness and to the vulnerable people of this world. So on this, the first Sunday after Christmas, we already have the refugee God fleeing in terror and faced with suffering and death. I know that's not the kind of reading and sermon most of us want to hear while we still have our Christmas trees up, and I well imagine that many of you will want me to not preach again if this is the kind of thing you're going to get from me. You probably want me to tell you more about Christingle and the oranges, but that's not where we are. And how many of us, in our secret moments, even at Christmas, have stood over the bed of a sleeping child, a grandchild, a niece, a nephew, or a special friend, and thought both of the promise and fear of the future? We've wished we could take away all that pain the child might know, all the danger. We've dreaded the day when some evil would enter that child's world that we couldn't keep away. In every newborn baby, there is a promise of a future, yet the hovering of danger, illness, and suffering. That is why Christmas for believers is not the saccharine Christmas of the world at large. A Christian Christmas holds innocence and its loss together in a kind of tension that only the heart feels. When only a week passes between Jesus' birth in a manger to save our lives and his escape to Egypt to save his life, we don't just realize this truth, we feel it. That's because we believe Christmas doesn't take away the possibility and potential of a broken heart. It purposely takes it on. So the biblical passage chosen for this week, though it's an abrupt and jarring and even harrowing one, rings oddly familiar and perhaps corresponds more closely to the world we live in than some other parts of the Christmas story. Later, in our prayers of intercession, we will pray for countries at war and for those in our society that are struggling with poverty, with heartbreak or loss. If this had not also been true for Jesus, then he would not have been one of us. It would have been scandalous, maybe even sacrilegious, if God had allowed Jesus to have grown up unscathed when so many children, then and now, face the dangers of hunger, neglect, abuse, and exile. The forced travels of Jesus and his family provide a powerful symbol for all refugees and oppressed people of the earth, a terrible reality of life that great many people in many parts of the world are simply at the mercy of political tyrants or unpredictable forces of nature that determine whether, where they will live, how they will live, even whether they will live at all. In Jesus, our faith says that God has taken on humanity completely. Early in his life, he was threatened by a dangerously insane ruler, and his poor family were on the run, desperate and terrified and determined to survive. Some of his earliest memories may have been sensing the fear of his parents' voices as they tell him not to play outside, as they hide him until they are beyond danger. Poverty and homelessness are not strangers to him. Joseph, Mary, and Jesus, were they warmly welcomed in Egypt? That's a question we can ask ourselves. And I'm afraid the answer is it's highly unlikely. As they and other refugees arrive, their Egyptian neighbours and officials surely complain about those people. They dress differently. They observe a different religion. They have to shop for special hard-to-find foods. And they don't know the local customs or and they have different holidays. That carpenter is going to take someone else's job. They need to learn our language, they might have heard. I think it's probable that these early life experiences and stories recounted by his parents helped to shape Jesus' later ministry to these people, the people on the margins, those who are set aside either by illness or race or are ostracized. We see him warmly accepting people from other places, religions, and races, eats with them, laughs with them, welcomes the outsider. To me, that is, and I think to the Bible, that is true incarnation. Jesus is Emmanuel, God with us, And so the God we meet in Jesus is not exempt from the tension, fear, and violence and horror of the world. And God's full-on embrace of the most difficult parts of our story reminds us that this world is not just broken, but also beloved. God is with us, even in the darkest times. We heard in the passage from the Hebrew Scriptures in Isaiah of God's great acts, of God's steadfast love, which are exemplified by the powerful memories of God saving Israel from their enemies, and especially from the houses of slavery in Egypt. It is not a bad idea to, at the beginning of this new year, to take a moment to see that God is for us, promising not only to accompany us through the difficult times, but also to bring us to the other side, so that in time we know the fullness of joy that is life in Christ. When you think about it, Emmanuel, God with us, wouldn't really mean that much if God was only with us during the tender moments of celebration, during the Christmas Eve services of our lives. Yet those moments of joy are a gift from God, and it's right to give thanks to God for them. But if we're glad that God is with us during the times of rejoicing, we're desperate to know that God is with us also in the times of grief, loss, and despair. Yes, this reading is tough to hear the week after Christmas, but it's for that reason it's also important. We're going to sing the next hymn now, which is a very special one.